are listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com. You're listening to The Legal Help Desk with Salar Atrazadeh, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Legal Help Desk radio program. As most of you know by now, on this exclusive radio program, we talk about legal principles, recent cases, and updates. Today, my guest is attorney Josh Friedman, principal and founder of Joshua P. Friedman & Associates. In today's discussions, we plan to talk about collections and judgment enforcement. Please bear in mind that our discussions are for general purposes only, and are not intended to create an attorney-client relationship. The law is complicated, and you should consult with a qualified attorney before taking legal action. Please make sure you do not disclose confidential information during this program. You may call us on the air at 818-602-4929. For your questions, you should visit my law firm's website, atrazadeh.com, and click on podcast to listen to archived interviews. You can also download them through iTunes or Stitcher under the news and politics categories. Mr. Friedman is an attorney specializing in collections and judgment enforcement. He has collected consumer and commercial debts and enforced millions of dollars in judgments for more than a decade. He regularly lectures and publishes articles on these topics for continuing education purposes, and has been named a super lawyer or super lawyer rising star for each of the past 6 years. Josh represents individuals, financial institutions, and everything in between. He has enforced judgments as small as a few thousand dollars and as large as $10 million or more. Josh, thank you for being a guest on today's program. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thank you for having me, and I look forward to it.
My pleasure. I think it's important for our audience to learn about judgment collection and debt enforcement for various reasons, whether it's a consumer debt or some kind of business transaction that went sour and for some reason the other party couldn't or did not pay. Ultimately, someone like yourself obtains a judgment through the judicial process and finally obtains a judgment for X amount of dollars. So that's the first step. That's maybe the easier step. The next step, and correct me if I'm wrong, is to track down the judgment debtors and basically have them pay the judgment creditor. Is that correct?
Absolutely. It's people think when they hire an attorney and they go to trial and they file a lawsuit, that if they prevail, they're instantly going to be rewarded with a check at the end of the day. And fortunately, I think the numbers are more than 80% currently in California of judgments never get satisfied, meaning that the prevailing party in the lawsuit never gets paid the money they're owed, despite the fact the court ordered that they're owed those monies.
Right, right. So when you go to court, you enforce the claims, or if you file a complaint and you win on the issues, whether through summary judgment or trial, the court gives you a piece of paper. It's usually called an order. And that says that the other party owes you, let's say, $10 million. But like you just mentioned, it's not a guarantee that you're going to get paid anything close to $10 million. So from a general perspective, when you first start enforcing a judgment, what are your goals?
Well, there's two goals when we start, and they both go on simultaneously. One doesn't take precedence over the other. The first goal is when you become a judgment creditor after you prevailed at court through a motion for summary judgment or trial or the like, you are just what's considered a general unsecured creditor, and we want to convert you from a general unsecured creditor to a secured creditor. So we need to create and file liens that will put you in the judgment creditor in a better position. In case the debtor files bankruptcy, and also in position against other creditors that might come in and attempt to seize that judgment debtor's assets. So that the first goal is to convert the position from a general unsecured creditor to a secured creditor. The second goal is the more obvious one, which is we want to collect the monies that our clients are owed.
Right. Right. And what are the methods you use to locate debtors' assets? Because they could hide the assets, they could transfer assets, they might plan to file for bankruptcy. So these are some of the potential pitfalls that a person who has the judgment against someone else might face in the future, correct?
Absolutely. And this is, locating debtors' assets is the most difficult part of the job. And it's really that there is no one easy way that fits all cases. If you're going after an individual's assets, the first thing you have to do is review their credit reports. There's a case in the Ninth Circuit that came down, it's got to be about 4 or 5 years ago, Pintos, which gave all judgment creditors the legal right to review credit reports for judgment debtors. So that gives you a very good picture, a starting point of where to look for their assets. You've also got to use different proprietary databases. There's LexisNexis, there's Westlaw that help, there's a company out of Florida called TLO. There's a whole lot of companies that are very good to help you as a starting point, and those really are only starting points. Those give you leads as to where assets potentially may be. Mm-hmm. Then you got to look at potentially subpoenaing third parties, including credit card companies, landlords. If the debtor has a mortgage, you want to get a copy of that mortgage application and see what information's in there. Get copies of checks, you want to subpoena banks. There's a whole host of parties, and when you subpoena one, that often leads you to subpoena a second, and then a third, and a fourth potential party. You also might want to consider if the costs justify it, and to doing judgment debtor examinations. Mm-hmm. Now, when I say judgment debtor examinations, it's a broad category. Under the California Code of Civil Procedure, there's really three types of judgment debtor exams, but for our purposes, there's really two types. It's under 708.110. There's a 708.120 and a 708.130, which basically says you could do an examination of the judgment debtor, him or herself, which is helpful, but usually not going to give you the most information. More importantly, is you could do examinations of third parties who you believe may have information about the judgment debtor's assets. This works well in if there's a divorce. Bring in the ex-spouse, they tell you everything. Mm-hmm. Bring in accountants, financial advisors. There's a whole host of people you might want to examine and bring into court, put them under oath, and ask these questions. And finally, if you still are sort of stuck, you might want to consider hiring a private investigator.
Right.
There is no one case fits all, but there's a whole host of options depending on how the case develops.
I see. So let's backtrack a little and distinguish a difference, if any, between state court judgments and federal court judgments in California. Is there a difference, number one, because judgments are renewable from what I understand, a 10-year period is how long it's good for, and before the 10-year period runs out, you're supposed to renew that judgment. So is there a difference between state or federal court in that respect?
In most respects, judgments and the process to enforce a judgment in California, whether it's a state or federal court, there is no difference. The federal court system borrows and applies the state court codes to enforcement procedures. Mm-hmm. The biggest difference, to be quite honest, is the post-judgment interest calculations. In state court in California, you get 10% simple interest per annum. So if you've got a $1,000 judgment, every year it accrues interest at $100
right.
a year. Now, federal court uses the rate. It's a complex equation, but you're basically getting, I think, about now in today's day and age, about 0.01% interest. Mm-hmm. So virtually no interest right now on federal judgments.
I see. That's the major difference. Okay.
Yes, I mean, you get differences in the, I'll call it also the seriousness of the judges. Mm-hmm. Federal judges sometimes are a little bit stricter and enforce the codes stronger than some state judges are a little bit more lax, especially when it comes to a pro se defendant, judgment debtor. But by code, they're virtually identical otherwise.
Okay. All right. And they're both renewable before the 10-year period runs out, correct?
Absolutely. So a judgment's good for 10 years. You've got to give yourself time to renew it because the court clerks with budget cuts and the like are backed up beyond belief. So you should do it more often. The other thing you might want to consider when you're renewing a judgment is compounding interest. So if we go back to my example of the $1,000 judgment, after 5 years, it's worth $1,500. If you renew it at 5 years, you'll start getting 10% interest based on that $1,500 number, which is $150 a year. So you're getting interest on interest. If you wait to the 10-year mark, the judgment's now worth $2,000, but you get, and when you renew it, you'll get $200 of interest a year. However, you gave up that $500 each year in that 5 years. So you could renew, a judgment needs to be renewed every 10 years. The first time you may renew it whenever you would like. Every subsequent renewal can be no more frequently than every 5 years.
I see. So it's renewable before the 10-year period runs out then?
Absolutely. You don't want to wait to that 10-year. Typically, depending on my judgments, I calendar to renew every five and seven years.
Okay.
To get that interest and to avoid any chance that the clerk may reject it,
right,
may have be backlogged or the like.
Right. That's great advice because for the folks who just tuned in, we're talking about judgment debt collection and regulations and rules. And it's a complicated process. It's a specialty that Josh has. And, you know, the clerks, whether you're in state or federal court, may come up with issues or questions or concerns that you have to take back that document, renew it or amend it, modify it, and then submit it again for the court's review. So it's not a simple slam dunk guaranteed process every time it's done. That's important for the listeners to know. Wouldn't you agree with me, Josh?
Absolutely, and that's the one issue is there definitely you have to dot every I, cross every T, and if you put a comma in the wrong place, the clerk's going to reject it and kick it back to you. Mm-hmm. The other issue really to take into effect right now, as we're sitting here in 2014, are the budget cuts that are still affecting, especially the state courts. L.A. County, most L.A. County courts right now to renew a judgment are taking approximately 4 months for the clerks to process. There was a large number of consumer debt lawsuits that were filed and judgments entered in the years 2005 through 2007, mm-hmm. which means those are really coming up for renewals, and the courts have system has not figured out a way to deal with this expected flood of renewals in the next year to two. So they're going to back up. It's going to take them 6 months to a year to process renewals for filings in the next 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Josh, how did you get into this business? How did you get into the specialization of collection and debt enforcement, if you don't mind me asking?
Absolutely. I really fell into it, to be quite frank. I went to Loyola Law School. I started my career at Shepard Mullin in downtown in Los Angeles.
Big law firm, yes.
I think a few hundred attorneys down there. And to be quite frank, wasn't enjoying being at a big law firm. It had nothing to do against that specific firm. Just didn't want to be at a big law firm anymore. I started with my best friend from law school. We had one client that purchased millions and millions of dollars of what's called credit card charge-offs. Those are, if you don't pay your credit card minimum payments every month, they charge them off. It's an accounting term. They remove them as an asset off the books, and they sell them for pennies on the dollar in the open market. And our client was buying millions of these and wanted another law firm to help them collect down in Southern California. They hired, at that time, they had probably about 26 attorneys across the country doing their collections. They wanted one down here in the L.A. area. Mm-hmm. So we started with them, got a great education, a great experience for a few years, and then went on my own a few years later.
Interesting, interesting. I think, you know, the specialty areas that we're having in the legal practice now, and it, the day and age of general practice has faded away. And we all need to specialize in some area, as you are and I am in relation to internet and cyber law. So people need to understand that a general practitioner may know a lot about the law, but he or she may not know specifically about the guidelines related to judgment collections or debt enforcement, things like that. So my general suggestion to our listeners is to hire someone who specializes in the area that you're having difficulties with, whatever it is, family law, criminal practice, debt collections, and things like that. So I'm going to make a quick announcement, just make sure that the listeners know who we are interviewing today. Folks, if you just tuned in, I'm interviewing Josh Friedman, principal and founder of Joshua Friedman & Associates, located in Santa Monica Boulevard in Beverly Hills, California. His telephone number is 310-278-8600. His website is losangelescollector.com. Josh, again, thank you for being on the program, and I really appreciate your time today. I think what we need to talk about next is some of the most common ways to enforce a judgment against an individual, whether it's, like you said, the judgment debtor exam or the wage garnishment or levying assets. Would you mind elaborating on those methods?
Absolutely. So we talked already a little bit about how to locate the assets or the processes used to locate assets. And then what really happens is you locate an asset and then you figure out what legal process you need to take those assets, seize those assets. Most assets are available for levy. A levy basically means you get a document called a writ of execution from the court, and this document is, in essence, instructions from the court to the local sheriff, informing the sheriff they have the legal right to seize certain assets up to a certain dollar amount, that dollar amount being the amount of the judgment, plus interest if there's any court added costs in there as well. So once that writ has been issued, you find an asset, most assets are available to levy, like I said. So you want to levy, the most common ones for individuals, as you probably could guess, are bank accounts. If you know where someone banks, you could, with the help of the sheriff, you could go in, see, without telling the other side you're going to do it, go seize the money right out of their bank accounts. The other very common way is to garnish someone's wages. It's called an earnings withholding order. Again, with this writ of execution, with the help of the sheriff or a private process server, you go serve these certain documents on the employer, and you're allowed to take up to 25% of the judgment debtor's wages from every pay period. Then beyond those two most common, depends on what assets the individual has. If the debtor is owed money from third parties, debtor is owes money for owns an apartment building and has tenants, or whether the judgment debtor works as a independent contractor, you could go garnish those wages or levy those monies that are owed. If the debtor has interest in limited liability companies or partnerships, you can go get what's called a charging order and attach the proceeds from those entities. If the judgment debtor owns stock, if they have even a retirement account, 401ks are exempt, but other ones are not automatically exempt,
right,
you could go levy those stock accounts. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of different ways to go after the debtor. It all goes back to what assets you found initially.
I see. So the wages can be garnished without a court order include unpaid income taxes, court-ordered child support, child support arrears, and defaulted student loans. So these are the exceptions to the rule, correct?
Well, right. I mean, you don't need a, you need a, once you have a judgment, you don't need a court order to, technically a writ of execution is a court order, but it's a procedural court order that you're going to get from the court clerk as opposed to going to a judge in a motion.
Right.
You get that writ of execution, and which, and then you take that to the sheriff, and then you could go garnish their wages right away.
I see. Okay. And the levying of bank accounts and, let's say, safe deposit boxes, those do not need to be notified, or you don't need to provide notification to the other side telling them that you're going to do that, correct?
Correct. There's very few instances you need to give advance notice to the others, to the judgment debtor, that you're going to seize assets. Those are notice motions. The typical notice motions that you see are charging orders, assignment orders. Those are the most common. But anything else, you don't give them. You would never give the judgment debtor notice because they would just take their assets and move them.
I see. So, what are some of the common pitfalls? Let's say you're the judgment creditor and you have a judgment, you know, in your hand, a writ of execution that says you're allowed to collect on your debt, and you want to go through the process of either garnishment or levy, the ORAP process, which is the judgment debtor's exam. What are some of the pitfalls, the common pitfalls that our listeners need to know about for the process?
Yeah, each aspect has its own sort of common pitfalls. The first is getting that writ of execution. Sometimes it can be a little bit more difficult than people think. Whether you don't fill out every box so the court clerk will reject it, whether you don't put the comma or the period, so if you sued Joshua P. Friedman & Associates, comma, Inc., if you didn't put that comma in there, it's going to be rejected. If you didn't put the period after Inc., it's going to be rejected. Then when it comes time to levy bank accounts, you need to know whose name the bank account is held in. If it's not held in the name of your judgment debtor, but it's held in the name of your judgment debtor's children, their business, some other third party that's helping them hide money, you need to know how it's held. So your instructions to the sheriff and any potential other court orders or motions for alter egos and the like, so you can have those done properly. The biggest pitfall I see with judgment debtor exams, and this is why they get sometimes expensive, is there's two big pitfalls. One is judgment debtor exams. People think once they get a judgment debtor, show up for a judgment debtor exam, they're going to come there and just tell them where all their monies are hidden, where they keep all their assets.
Right.
Never happens. One in a million it happens. Every other time, you're going to hear a claim of poverty and lies, quite frankly. So you got to be ready that you're not getting that information. There's other reasons to do judgment debtor exams, to locate their assets. When you're doing a judgment debtor exam of the judgment debtor, him or herself, it's not to locate the assets. The other thing to really remember is the judgment debtor exams must be personally served on the judgment debtor. You cannot serve their attorney. You cannot leave it with the wife or husband at the house. Can't leave it with the secretary at the job. It must be hand-delivered to the debtor themselves.
I see.
So if it's not, it's ineffective and it's bad service.
I see. And they could be rejected and revoked, for lack of better terms, by the court.
Absolutely. It could be quashed. A simple motion to quash would get it thrown out.
Right. Years back, my law firm was involved in a lawsuit in federal court, and we obtained a judgment against several individuals who were involved in a mortgage predatory lending lawsuit. We had the bank involved, we had the FDIC involved, the real estate brokers, the agents, even the notary public, who was basically involved in the transaction. And ultimately, over the course of a year and a half, almost 2 years of litigation in federal court, we obtained a judgment against the remaining defendants, the individual defendants, the brokers, the notary public, and one corporation for $118,000. However, we face the common predicament of not being able to track down the defendants. Those defendants hadn't responded to the complaint, to the summons and complaint, so we didn't know their actual location. We weren't in contact with them. They basically played the game of incognito, for lack of better terms, during the course of litigation. And that's still the case. This judgment was obtained probably around 2012, and my client has a piece of paper in his hands saying that these individuals and defendants owe him $118,000. Granted, one defendant, the least guilty defendant, to be honest with you, who was the notary public, came forward, honestly came forward in good faith, and paid out a portion of the judgment. But the remaining balance is still there. So I guess my question to you in a common situation like this is, how does the plaintiff slash claimant follow and find these people? They're still hiding under their radar, if you understand what I'm saying. What would be your proposition to someone like that?
Absolutely, and that's not uncommon, unfortunately. The question I always ask first is, how was the judgment debtor served? And it sounds like, in your case, it's probably served by some version of publication.
Right.
So that's where it gets difficult, because if you weren't able to locate them, because you were supposed to, at least, and anyone that serves by publication is supposed to use due diligent efforts to what they call skip trace, which is to locate the debtors. And then if they can't locate the debtors or the defendants at that point in time, then the court's allowed to order a motion to serve by publication. But so if you weren't able to skip, it all comes down to skip tracing again, which it should have been done up in advance. So I'm leery always to take those type of cases where they were served by publication. It's one thing to have a default judgment. It's another to have service by publication. I also fear that they'll come back someday and file a motion to have the judgment set aside for bad notice, bad service, etc. But with regards to those, it comes down to skip tracing. It comes down to doing a better job, quite frankly, than whether you guys did it or your prior law firm, or if you outsource the skip tracing services to a private investigator, like doing a better job than they did and to find these debtors. That's really comes down to it. And sometimes it comes down to, you know, bringing in for a judgment debtor exam if there are multiple defendants all working together, for example, in the same company. Maybe some of these other guys are still friends with them. Maybe they really know them, and they're just helping them hide, or they're just not getting involved. And bringing some of those coworkers into court. And most people, when they're not the debtor themselves and get there in front of that black robe, they tend to tell the truth. Mm-hmm. So if they know where the person is, or if they've talked to the person, or if they have any leads, they know where the judgment debtor's mother lives, they'll usually tell you that information.
They usually do. And again, this was a very difficult case for the client, because he had lost the house and there was obvious mortgage fraud and predatory lending practices on behalf of the brokers, because they spoke Spanish. They lured my client into signing specific documents that he should not have signed. He wasn't qualified for that kind of financing. And someone should have told him. Someone should have told him that this is not in your best interest. You are ultimately going to lose the house. You're getting yourself in too deep, for lack of better terms, and you're going to find trouble down the line. So that didn't happen. They got him to trust them, again, through, you know, the common language issues, and ultimately, you know, the client signed the contracts, obtained the loan, the mortgage, and after a couple of years was facing balloon payments and high APR interest rates, and lost the house, where he had equity. He had significant equity in the house. So that was the case, and now it's difficult for someone to spend more money and try to go after these bad guys. correct me if I'm wrong, you generally accept these cases on contingency, straightforward, not hourly, or hybrid, correct?
Yes, I probably have 80% or so of my cases are on a straight contingency plus cost system. I've got plenty of hourly clients too that fit in there. People don't want to give away a chunk of what they think they're entitled to and owed. I've also got hybrids where there's a payment plus a contingency, a success fee, or something along those lines. But absolutely, the majority of my cases are a contingency, a traditional contingency fee structure.
Okay. All right. And let's move on to my next question to you. We talked about some of the common ways to enforce a judgment against an individual, a person. But what are some of the common ways to enforce a judgment against a business, a corporation, an LLC?
So businesses are slightly different. You obviously first want to look at their bank accounts. Bank accounts are great and for businesses because businesses, individuals move bank accounts more frequently than businesses do. Mm-hmm. Businesses stay with the same bank account for years on top of years. So if the client who is my judgment creditor ever did business with this judgment debtor business or corporation, often they have a copy of an old check, a pay stub, something from a payment, something from this back of a check, something that they did business with this judgment debtor. And that's where you start, obviously, with the business again. The other item is businesses typically make money by providing goods or services to other businesses. So if you're a law firm, you provide legal services for companies and or individuals. If you're an accounting firm, you do accounting services for different individuals. If you sell widgets, you've got buyers of those widgets.
Right.
Now, when you do so that company, that judgment debtor that provides those goods or services has an accounts receivable. Mm-hmm. They provide these services, they provide these goods, and some third party owes our judgment debtor money. You are allowed to levy, which is the quickest, fastest, and cheapest way to go about it, levy a judgment debtor's accounts receivables. So if, Solar, you did work for IBM, I go levy with the help of the sheriff, this process I described, the writ of execution, the levy, IBM, and I say, I want all payments that are owed to Solar and all accounts receivables and all monies owed, pay them over to the sheriff instead of paying Solar directly. And therefore, and the money, that third party will comply because of the liability, they don't want to take on that kind of liability and get in the fight. And you can go after that third party. And as soon as that happens, the business then, we hear from the businesses all the time because they don't want their name also being tarnished in the community as we're levying their accounts receivables.
I see. So that's the big difference between individuals and corporations, because corporations do business. Like you said, they have business accounts. They sell widgets, which, by the way, aren't real products. And there's a way to trace the assets. And I think it's maybe easier, if I'm not mistaken. Is it easier to trace assets of businesses, or is it easier to do that for individuals in your experience?
Actually, it varies, to be honest. I hate to give the lawyer answer. Individuals finding assets are easy because credit reports, so much information is on your credit report, mm-hmm. and that's such a great starting point for an individual that you get so much information there. Where individuals, companies and businesses don't have a real credit report. However, what businesses often have is a website that says who their best customers are, uses them as examples.
Mm-hmm.
So they give you, a lot of businesses give you that information for free by just going to their company website.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you find out who they're doing business with, and then you subpoena their records to find out what kind of transactions they were engaged in, correct?
No, I don't even, you don't, you subpoena, once you subpoena records from a third party, you've tipped your hand and told the judgment debtor mm-hmm. that you know about this asset and you're coming to get this asset.
Okay.
Instead of subpoenaing, you levy the asset, you go after, and you get, so essentially you have a court order now, a writ is a court order, even though it's a very simple one to get, that says any money this business is owed from IBM, pay us instead. Don't pay them. Now, if I get a response that says we don't owe them any money, we don't do business with them, et cetera, then I'll subpoena their records afterwards to verify what they're telling me. But I levy it right away and just hit them hard and hit them strong so my clients can get paid.
Interesting. So that's the best method to do that, because once you, like you said, subpoena records, that becomes, there needs to be notification. And the other party, the judgment debtor, will be notified about that. So your hand is open now. Your strategy is basically told and informed. They're informed about your strategy. And then you lose momentum. So I understand now the methods you're talking about. What about a situation where, let's say we file a lawsuit in federal court and ultimately we find out, you know, it was a John Doe lawsuit, and then the perpetrator / culprit calls the lawyer and says, it was me, I did all this against your client, and I don't have money. Unfortunately, I don't have money. I live with my parents. I only have $100 in my name, and I really can't pay your client anything at all. We just know that person's name, his state of residency, his address, but we don't know. Well, we also know his date of birth, for example, but not his Social Security number. What can you do to confirm his financial status, whether or not he has any money?
It's scary today's day and age on the internet. You give me a person's name and their last known address, even if it's 4 or 5 years ago, and as long as it's not a generic person name like John Smith or even Josh Friedman, I could get you their Social Security number, their mother's maiden name. If we've got a legal right, in this case, if we've got a judgment against them, we could run their credit reports. We'll have all that information in under 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. So it's really, when you subscribe to all these databases and the like, and you have access to this information, it's amazing how much information is out there on the internet.
And the cost for that, it varies, obviously, but what's the average cost to do something like that, to find out more about the person and then find out more information about their bank accounts or assets in the United States, at least?
So it varies. Our offices do asset searches as well as part of our collection process. There are lots of asset companies out there. I'm not going to speak to the quality or lack thereof of any individual one. But there are lots. If we are retained to do the judgment enforcement, we do the asset search as part of our judgment enforcement. If we are hired just to do the asset search, it depends on how in-depth the client wants us to go. They range anywhere from usually about $750 to $2,500, depending on how in-depth and how detailed we're getting.
Okay. All right. So that gives the potential judgment creditor another option before he or she decides to pursue this case, because let's say we haven't pursued the case, we haven't served them with the summons and complaint, we just know that he or she exists, he's the one that has engaged in misconduct, illegal conduct against the client. Granted, he might be in another state, but at least he's in the United States. We know his name, address, telephone number, potentially date of birth. So there is a way to do an asset search to confirm his statements that I don't have any money. I only have $100 to my name.
Absolutely. I mean, you're going to hear that. You hear that from all the defendants across the world. And we get hired often by other law firms, actually, that want it, before they file their lawsuit, want to make sure it's worthwhile to get involved in the lawsuit. So they ask us to do asset searches. We also get it from a lot of personal injury attorneys that are filed a lawsuit, are in negotiations with the insurance carrier for the other party, and the insurance carrier has informed them they only have coverage for $15,000. We're offering the full policy limits to settle this case. Will you take it? And our personal injury attorney wants to know, should they take it, or are there going to be other assets of this potential judgment debtor that they could go after they get a judgment? Mm-hmm. So there's lots of times asset searches are very valuable and helpful in the legal process.
Good, good, good. Folks, we have Joshua Friedman on the air with us. If you just tuned in, his office is located at 9903 Santa Monica Boulevard, Suite 1108, Beverly Hills, California. And his telephone number is 310-278-8600. His website is losangelescollector.com. Mr. Friedman specializes in collections and judgment enforcement. Josh, I think we need to also talk about how we can improve the creditor's standing in case the debtor files for bankruptcy. Because that happens, right? You get a judgment, and the person who owes the money finds out about the judgment order and then says, okay, well, sorry, before you turn yourself into a secured creditor from unsecured to secured creditor, I'm going to file a Chapter 7 or some other chapter under the bankruptcy code. What is your recommendations on this specific issue?
So when a case comes to me, usually if the debtor is even considering bankruptcy, they're either going to file bankruptcy when the lawsuit's filed or during the litigation process, which is before I come into the case, or when I put too much pressure on them and they want to get me to leave them alone. They don't usually file it right when the judgment's entered. That's very rare. So that's what goes back to what we were talking about from a general perspective, what I do when I first start enforcing judgments. So what I first want to do, simultaneously, is convert us from because when you get a judgment, you're a general unsecured creditor. We want to convert ourselves from a general unsecured creditor to a secured creditor. And there's certain things you could do, and they've got to be seasoned for 90 days, so they're not considered preferential liens, and then you become a secured creditor going forward. So there's really three ways to do that. One is you need to file a lien with the California Secretary of State. It's a very simple form. You go to the California Secretary of State website, do a search for a lien. It's like $10 per debtor. You file with them. And then you've got lien on all kinds of different personal property assets of the judgment debtor. It's sort of similar to a UCC lien, I'll call it. The other item you want to do is you want to get the court clerk to issue an abstract of judgment, again, a very simple judicial counsel form, and then you will record that in the every county you believe the judgment debtor owns real property. Mm-hmm. So if they own a home or vacant lot in Los Angeles County, you get that abstract issued by the court. You recorded it with the L.A. County Recorder's Office, and in 90 days, you are a secured creditor on that real property that's either owned today by the judgment debtor or owned in the future. The debtor doesn't even have to have it. I make it a practice, quite frankly, of recording liens in the county where my judgment debtor's parents live. So in case my judgment debtor inherits any property, they want to inherit it and flip it quickly after their parents have passed, I'm a lien holder as soon as it passes to them. The final way to convert yourself from an unsecured to a secured creditor is by filing and serving a judgment debtor exam. We talked about judgment debtor exam for other purposes. This is one of the reasons you want it. When you serve a judgment debtor exam, a notice of judgment debtor exam on the judgment debtor and personally serve it, it creates a lien from 1 year from the date of issuance, not even the date of service, date of issuance, which is usually a month before you serve the debtor.
Right.
From a date of issuance of the judgment debtor exam for 1 year going forward. And you can make a motion with the court to extend that 1 year. A perfect example is I had a judgment debtor that we had, $200,000+ judgment. We served him with a judgment debtor exam. He was slowly making payments, but not enough. Eventually filed bankruptcy about 120, 160 days later. He filed the bankruptcy right after we hit his bank account and found $75,000 in the bank account. When it came time, and then he filed bankruptcy. when we went to the bankruptcy, their first response is, we want this lien removed and the $75,000 returned to the judgment debtor because it's an invalid lien. It's within 90 days of the bankruptcy filing. It's a preferential transfer.
Right.
And I explained to the court, the trustee, that I'm a secured lien holder because of my judgment debtor exam lien, which had already been seasoned for 180 days or 160 days. I forgot exactly how much. Mm-hmm. The trustee agreed with me and gave me the $75,000.
Wow. Wow. Then you had a very happy client.
So. They were entitled to 250 or so. So they were very happy that they got the 75, obviously. But they of course wanted the 250.
Right.
But they were happy with the process to the extent that we got more than any other creditor in that bankruptcy, substantially more. And percentage-wise, outrageously more. I think no one else got more than 2 cents on the dollar, and we got, when all was said and done, 35 or so 40 cents on the dollar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's certainly something, and it's certainly better than, like you said, most of the other creditors received. So that's good. The other issue or question that came across my mind is, what can you do if our, let's say, the debtor hides all of his assets in the business, or vice versa? What do you usually do when that happens?
That happens quite a bit. That's not unusual, especially when you've got a debtor that owns their own business. You got to start off with lots of discovery, subpoenaed bank records, copies of statements, checks, third-party judgment debtor exams. You have to confirm and get verifiable, admissible proof that what you believe in your gut is actually going on, that these assets are being, that he's living off of the business or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get that, there's a few things you could do, and you want to do these all sort of simultaneously because the goal is to put as much pressure on this debtor all at once that they see the walls around them caving in, that they come to you to try to settle this matter. So you want to file a motion for an alter ego, which would In essence, what this motion says is that the corporation or business is the same as the individual because they don't keep any kind of corporate structures and proper lines drawn there. So therefore, we should add the corporation itself to the judgment because they are one and the same.
Right.
You also, if the business is a corporation, you want to get what's called a turnover order. This is an order from the court that says, the judgment debtor owns stock in this corporation, in the corporation you have stock, owns stock, and we want the court to order the judgment debtor to turn those shares of his shares of stock over to the sheriff and sell them at a public auction.
I see.
Then you could credit bid your judgment, and you're technically the owner of the corporation, which doesn't make a lot of sole proprietors happy.
Mm-hmm.
If the business is an LLC or a partnership, you get what's called a charging order. A charging order is an order that the LLC or partnership distribute any monies that are owed to the judgment debtor, for example, any distributions or the like, all of those, paid to the judgment creditor instead of being paid to the judgment debtor any forward. It puts a lien on the judgment debtor's interest in this LLC or partnership. And if the LLC or partnership is not complying, you have the option to foreclose on this charging order and become a member of that LLC, or the option of bringing a creditor suit against them as well.
Okay.
And the final way also is, if the business owes money to our judgment debtor or is paying their debts for them, or is paying their car payments, paying their mortgage, their rent, anything like that, you could also levy that business itself, saying, look, you owe money to judgment debtor. It's an intangible right our judgment debtor has. We want you to, per the court order, the levy, which is the writ of execution and through the sheriff that we talked about before, we want you to levy that asset and pay it to the sheriff instead of paying to the judgment debtor. And if you fail to comply, sue that company in a creditor suit. I guess the final way you can also do it is there is a code that says, with court permission, which means you need to get a court order, you can levy bank accounts that are held in third parties' names.
Mm-hmm.
So if the bank account, even if it's in the corporate name as opposed to the individual's name, if the court gives you permission, which goes back to the only way they're going to give you this permission is if you could bring them a ton of discovery and admissible evidence that we talked about when we started this discussion, bring all this evidence to them and say, look, they are one and the same. Let me levy the corporate business account. Then you're going to levy it. And then if they file a claim of exemption saying this was improper, when they file a claim of exemption, the burden is on the party bringing that claim of exemption to prove the facts that they're bringing, which means it's going to shift the burden to the debtor to prove that they are not one and the same as their business.
I see. So there's no commingling or grounds for piercing the corporate veil, for lack of better terms.
Well, piercing the corporate veil is, I mean, that's the same as, in essence, the same as an alter ego motion. That's going to hold the business liable for the individual's debts. That's the same analysis goes into the alter ego motion.
Okay. All right. Can I ask you one more question before we end the program? Because we're reaching the last couple of minutes. I have one more question for you.
Absolutely. Shoot.
If the judgment is against the spouse, can the attorney pursue the other non-debtor spouse's assets to enforce the judgment? This goes back to our brief discussion before the program started, you know, the assignments of rights to payment and living of community property. So would you mind elaborating on that briefly, please?
Yeah, I'll do it briefly, so because there is a lot of detail that could go into it.
I'm sure.
Generally speaking, the community property is liable for the debt of either spouse. So therefore, if you have a judgment against one spouse, generally speaking, you can levy the assets of the other spouse. So if you levy a bank account and it's held in the non-debtor spouse's name, you could do that without a court order. It's very easy to get a court order to garnish the wages of the non-debtor spouse. It does require a motion, but it's a very simple motion. The analysis really comes down to when the debt was incurred versus when the marriage occurred. If the debt predated the marriage, you might not be able to go after it, unless then the parties commingle their funds.
Right.
But if they keep their assets separate and the debt occurred prior to the marriage, it's tough. If the debt occurred after the marriage, it's easy. And if they commingle, it's easy.
I see. So the short answer is yes, but it depends on the scenario, as always.
Exactly. That's the world of law we live in.
It's the law is gray for the most part. It's not black or white. It's mostly gray. So I hope people appreciate that. Folks, we had Joshua Friedman on the air with us. He's a collection and debt enforcement attorney. His law firm is located in Santa Monica Boulevard in Beverly Hills, California. His telephone number is 310-278-8600. His website is losangelescollector.com. Josh, thank you again for being on the program. I look forward to seeing you and talking to you in the near future.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Sure thing. Take care.
See you soon.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Down.